So I wanted to begin, I wanted to talk about the idea of a beloved community, and specifically the beloved community in context of my own story, my own entry into a particular beloved community. But first I'd like to begin by reading two of Dr. King's thoughts on the beloved community. The solidarity of the human family is a phrase he frequently used to express the idea of the beloved community. We are tied together in the single garment of destiny, caught in an inescapable network of mutuality. And you may remember that Sandra spoke about this very sentiment this morning. And then he went on to say that whether we realize it or not, each of us lives eternally in the red. And he had a recognition of each of our indebtedness to past generations, and that personal growth can take place apart from meaningful relationships with other persons. And he said about the beloved community at a particular gathering, he said, as I stood with them and saw white and Negro, nuns and priests, ministers and rabbis, labor organizers, lawyers, doctors, housemaids and shop workers, brimming with vitality and enjoying a rare companionship, I knew I was seeing a microcosm of the mankind of the future in this moment of luminous and genuine brotherhood. And I guess I want to just say that part of my transformation from someone when I was a younger man who felt that my destiny was of my own making, and that all I had to do was to go forth into life and work hard and get what I deserved, was very much an ethos that I lived by. And I was very much a loner and took pride in being a loner and felt that I had very little use for community and that I was always outside community. And then I had the great blessing of meeting my wife, Sylvia, 22 years ago. And Sylvia was African-American, was raised in the segregated South in Richmond, Virginia. And her experience of life as a woman, especially a black woman, was very different from my experience as a white man from the North. She knew well the experience of not being able to go into certain stores, couldn't go into the movie theater except in the balconies, wasn't able to go to certain schools that she wanted to. And these were all tremendously painful and soul-searing experiences. And then she moved up north, went to school at Yale. In those days, again, a black woman being in Ivy League college was a rarity. And she had to learn how to enter a different kind of community and had to deal with the response of her being a black woman in the North, which was tremendously different kind of experience than being a black woman in the South. And when I met her, I fell in love with her, not so quickly. It took time. We began as friends, but in some ways, she was my teacher from very early on, and she knew all about community and derived a great sense of strength and solace from community. We developed our relationship, and at a certain point, before I had met her, I planned to travel the world for a couple of years, and she, in her wisdom and patience, said, go forth into the world with my blessing. Chances are you'll come back a better person. And you need to do some soul-searching and some eye-opening for yourself. She said, if you intend on spending the rest of your life with a black woman, then, she had this great expression, you do your own damn work. I said, what do you mean by that, do your own damn work? That sounds pretty cold and harsh. And she said, you know, growing up the way that I did and the way that I still have to contend with life is that I'm really tired of trying to educate white folks. And it's really incumbent upon you, Gary, to educate yourself and to do the learning that's necessary for you. So she sent me to what I call the University of Sylvia. She gave me a long reading list, everyone from Alice Walker to Achebe to Franz Fanon, to really open my eyes and heart to my own privilege, to the power of colonialism around the world, and the power of colonialism in one's heart that one can hold on to even long before the occupiers have left. So I did that, and in the process learned a great deal about myself, about my blindness to my own privilege. I remember once I was talking, I forget what specifically it was, and there was, I had some ambition about something. I was young and ambitious, and she stopped me. But in a very gentle way, in a very loving way, she asked me, why do you think you deserve that? Whatever that was. And I was really struck dumb by the question. No one had ever asked me that kind of question. No one had ever challenged me. And I remember saying something like, well, I deserve it because I worked toward it. And she said, well, that's no answer. Why do you deserve it? Why do you deserve it more than someone else? And that began a whole dialogue about my sense of deservedness and the interconnection between my sense of deservedness and other people who might not have the same sense of deservedness or the opportunity of deservedness. So I was fortunate in that she was able to, while I was traveling, come and meet me at various places, and traveling together was a very intimate and revealing process. And the more that we traveled together, the more I realized that I really did want to be with this person. And I remember that she was flying back to New York, I think we were in Kathmandu, Nepal. It was our last night together. And she started crying. And I asked her what was going on. And she said that she wasn't sure that she could spend her life with a white man. That what would that mean for her? What would that mean for her politically? What would that mean for her family? For all the work that she's had to do. And it was a very painful recognition of the consequences of us coming together. She flew away. Fortunately, long story short, we came together. We married. We have a beautiful daughter who's now 15. And when I think about Dr. King's speech of I Have a Dream, that we, my family, is really a direct beneficiary of the beloved community way back then that he was originally referring to, that over the decades has evolved into all kinds of beloved communities. And I consider today's community, even though we're spending just one day together, that there's enough potential for intimacy, understanding, connection, that makes this a beloved community. And so when I also think about Dr. King and what gave him strength, what gave him courage to do the extraordinary things that he did, he had so much faith in God. In fact, he would often say that with all the work that he and his compatriots have done, it's God and it's his love and faith in God that has inspired him and kept him going. And it's an interesting question for me because as a Buddhist, I don't have that sense of a God. But what I do have is a sense of Sangha, is a sense of beloved community. And at one point, the Buddha was asked by one of his foremost disciples, Ananda. And Ananda is wonderful in the liturgy because he fulfills this kind of everyman role where he's posing questions to the Buddha and the Buddha is able to respond in ways that are very illuminating. And Ananda at one point said to the Buddha, tell me, Lord, is the Sangha half of one's spiritual life? And the Buddha responded by saying, that's not so, Ananda. The Sangha, the community, is all of the spiritual life. And it's interesting that he places that in the triple gem, the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, that he in some ways elevates that as the primary inspiration and the force at work in one's spiritual life. Because he appreciated that none of us can do our spiritual work alone, that we need each other in so many ways in order for us to continue to do this work. And the Sangha, for me, is the bedrock of my faith and my foundation. And I have such appreciation for the Sangha, or the different Sanghas that we might be members of, because the Sangha is not just only a Buddhist Sangha per se, but it can be a Sangha of friends, it can be a Sangha of family, it can be a Sangha of diverse people coming together to support each other in their own actualization, both on an individual level and a collective level. So, as I'm talking about this, I have a great deal of gratitude to Sylvia, who took me from a young, somewhat brash man who was not aware of all that I had and all of my entitlements, and brought me into a place where I have a great deal of love and appreciation for the sanghas of which I'm a member. Even more so now because 5 months ago Sylvia died suddenly, unexpectedly. And the sanghas that she was a member of and some sanghas that she was the matriarch of were dealing with this loss. And in a time of loss, things that we take for granted or that seem so part of everyday life becomes ever more valuable. And sometimes we even see the value and the potency in a way that we never can while we still have it. So I offer this just really as one anecdote in making the other one that one knows, understands, and loves. And I remember we were talking about, as we were preparing to marry and looking at all the possible difficulties of that, and in fact we ultimately chose to elope just because it was easier for us. It was a tremendously selfish thing to do, but there was enough resistance on certain family members' parts that we decided to elope. But we were talking about what enables one to really make the other, to turn the other from a kind of a you to a thou. And I remember her saying that you've really got to like some aspect of the other's culture, whatever that might be. And not that you accept it, not that you tolerate it. Those are all very, those are fine words, but they don't go far enough, that you actually like and value some aspect of the other's culture. And that at least is an entry point into coming to love more of that other person. So I guess in summation, all that I really want to say is that for me and for her, that love really was an opening into going from a place of I should be more sensitive, I should be more aware, to wanting to, into a needing to understand and embrace the other. And one thing that I'm learning in these past few months, I always liked the Beatles. I always liked, except there's one song that I was never crazy about, All You Need Is Love. You all probably know that. Because my feeling is, well, no, that's not true. You don't only need love. You need to pay your mortgage. You need to pay your rent. You need to pay your bills. You need things like that. But what I've come to realize is that really all that I have to give is my love. That one, I experience this kind of crisis and loss, that one's material goods, one's station in life, that tends to fall away, and that the essence of our connecting, and the essence of what we have to give to each other, is our love.
I'm very glad that we strong-armed him into staying with us today. That was really lovely. I have two stories that I wanted to share with you that I heard recently. One of them relates very closely to what Bill was sharing with us. The first one I heard on the radio about a woman named Morgan Jenness, who lived in New York in the early 80s, and she was a young woman then, had moved here to work in theater, and she was very sad, very troubled, had a troubled upbringing, and was really just having a hard time finding herself. And she became obsessed with Mother Teresa, really, really obsessed, reading about her all the time. And when Mother Teresa came to New York, Morgan basically became a stalker, and she was following Mother Teresa wherever she went. And one day, Mother Teresa was leaving her hotel, and Morgan finally brought the courage to go up to her, and she said, "Oh, Mother Teresa, I love you so much. You're just so amazing. You do so much good work, and the work you do is so important." And just going on and on, and she said, "Mother Teresa, I want to move to Calcutta and work with you." And Mother Teresa's, very patiently and kindly listening to her, she took her hand and she said, you don't do this work because you think it's important. You do this work because you love the people so much, you love the poor people of Calcutta so much that you can't be away from them. So, you know, Morgan felt totally busted. Like, Mother Teresa's going to bust you. That would be the way. But Mother Teresa, still holding her hand, said, well, what do you do? And Morgan said, oh, you know, I don't do anything that important. I work in a theater and I help to put on plays. And Mother Teresa said, you know, there are many famines in this world. And with my people, there's a famine of the body, a hunger of the body. And with your people, there's a hunger of the spirit. So stay here and feed your people. And the second story that I heard recently was is from Islam. And you may know charity is one of the five pillars of Islam. And every year at the end of the month of Ramadan, the Muslim families are asked to donate 2.5% of their earnings from the year to the needy. And it said that a group of poor people went to the Prophet Muhammad's brother-in-law, and they said, you know, what can we offer? We're poor, we have nothing to give. And he said, give your smiles. And make sure that every person that you come into contact with feels cared for. And I love those two stories. They're very simple. They're quite simple, but to me, they really speak to what many of you brought up, this idea that our practice is our life, and our life is our practice. That in our being in the world, we can be expressions of the sacred. And to me, the stories also really highlight two of my major anxieties, that I don't do enough and that I don't have enough. And I can basically turn and twist those onto any situation, you know, not only just the typical ideas of not working enough or not having enough material things. But the stories speak to, you know, if you feel that you don't do enough, then whatever it is you do, as you're doing it, you can offer it as an offering of nourishment to the people who you come in contact with. And if you don't feel that you have enough, that you can always be this joy and love that comes from within. And you know, I can think that I'm not active enough or not still enough, that I don't have enough material things or enough immaterial things. Or I don't have enough courage to not have anything. So I really honor these stories as ways for us to think about engaging with the world with this heart of generosity and this spirit of generosity. And I'm bringing this up right now because in a few minutes we're going to walk around the room and explore and engage with some of the things that we've put out that Bill mentioned at the start of the day. And part of that is going to be some stories and also some symbols of very inspiring heroes, spiritual heroes, these voices of freedom. And as Sandra beautifully pointed out, that this inspiration is not only about their accomplishments, but it's about the example they gave us for how to be in this world with that generosity of spirit, starting our action from a place of peace and love and compassion. I heard the Dalai Lama on a podcast the other day, and he was talking about how a Muslim friend of his told him that the true meaning of the word jihad is an extinguishing of basically greed, hatred, and delusion. And the Dalai Lama loved this. He said, oh, so Buddhists are true jihadists. And that's a life's work, to cultivate that lack of greed, that compassion and love, and that lack of delusion, this wisdom, and the lack of hatred, love for all beings. And sometimes I feel that I get caught up in my practice on the cushion, that I think mindfulness is just paying attention. But mindfulness is paying attention in a particular way, with this spaciousness that Gary described, that there's a sense of curiosity and wonder and generosity that is a part of mindfulness. And mindfulness, I learned recently, always co-arises with 18 factors, including tranquility and equanimity and all of these beautiful states, but always co-arises with metta, with loving kindness. So you can't have mindfulness without this sense of spaciousness, this sense of gentleness, this sense of love. And I'd really like us to explore today how we do bring this into our lives. And we'll, later in the afternoon, we're going to be talking about our action in the world and in beloved community. But right now, just to bring this sense of openness and spaciousness, compassion, love, friendliness, generosity to how we engage in this room. So in the same way that when our mind wanders or unwholesome factors arise in us on the cushion, we bring just a gentleness and a reminder to come back to our breath or to come back to our experience. To bring that same sense of curiosity and engagement as we move around the room. And to really bring that mindfulness of body and of breath, of our mind and heart, to everything that we're about to experience. And you'll see that on one wall are stories of voices of freedom, people who use their spiritual practice to make change in the world. And I find them so inspiring because they are examples of how moving from that sacred place of love and compassion is the not only the starting place, but the heart of our engagement. And they're also very inspiring because all of them are real innovators in how they engage with the world. So it's not only about their own practice and their personal practice, but really deeply contemplating what is the way to engage and discovering unique ways, some of which are very challenging people around them, challenging systems, challenging laws, breaking laws. And so to really see them as almost giving us permission to find our own ways, when we're moving from that place of sacredness, of love and compassion, to do it in a way that feeds our people in our own authentic way. There are also questions that are posted. There are markers on both sides of the room that you can use to answer any of those questions. And there's also an altar with some objects and books that you can engage with. We're going to do this silently and mindfully. Please don't feel like you have to read everything, answer all the questions, or answer any questions. To really bring a sense of gentleness with how you move about the room. To really experience, again, your body, your mind, your heart, as you take it all in. We're going to have about 20 minutes, and I'll ring the bell when there are 5 minutes left, and then I'll ring it 3 times when you're coming back, and we'll come back and share after that. Okay, thank you.
I was really inspired by listening to the comments that you were making. And it ties right into the comments that I had planned to make. In a sense, it's a little embarrassing for me to make the comments that I was about to make because I was going to start off, and will start off, by saying that I come to this program kicking and screaming. You know, it's all of my three partners tripled up on me, you know, in terms of, yes, you should do this. And I kept saying, no, 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 I don't want. I resigned a couple of times. And a lot of emails, a lot of conversations. And it was actually the culmination of the different conversations. And maybe the last one that I had with my buddy Gary over here, where I felt that it was really time to get past the resistance and telling people, no, I don't want to do this, and sort of to dig in and try to explain why I had that feeling. And when I did that, what I came up with was sort of the embarrassing admission that I was very judgmental about the Martin Luther King celebrations that I had attended, because what I left, and I've been working on judgmentalness all my life, and it's been a pretty long life, and making some headways, but you know, it's tough. But anyhow, the judgmentalness was, here are a bunch of people that come, you know, to these sessions, and they like to sing We Shall Overcome, you know, and feel good and so forth about, you know, the whole process. But my question is, what are they doing, you know, to make things better? You know, are they doing anything more than singing We Shall Overcome? And so I realized that, and then what really surprised me, even, I guess, when I looked more deeply, that the judgmental, and I realized that the judgmentalness was really not about them, but was about me. Because in looking back, you know, I was around in the 50s and 60s, you know, I was an adult in the 50s and 60s when all this was going on, when Martin and all the other people were having the civil rights campaign. But I didn't go to any of the marches. I didn't march. I didn't go to any of the rallies. As a matter of fact, I was in graduate school in Boston when the March on Washington occurred. And a couple of dear friends, a Jewish married couple, really tried to get me to go to Washington, to the march. And I said, no, you know, I'm not sure what excuse I made, but it may have been I got to study and so forth. But when I looked, you know, more deeply at that, it was, I didn't go because in the family that I grew up in, we weren't the type of, quote, activists that would go out and march on the street. That was sort of a little below us, you know, sort of, I grew up in Washington, D.C. Some of you may have heard of E. Franklin Frazier, who wrote the book Black Bourgeoisie. And we were sort of in that black bourgeoisie, which meant, you know, these were the professional Negroes of the time, the lawyers, the doctors, the educators, and so forth. And sort of, it was below us, in effect, to go out on the street and to, you know, to do anything, you know, no matter what the purpose was. You know, those were for other people. And I didn't really, at the time, look deeply into what was stopping me from going. But certainly looking back, that was part of it. And in reflecting on the fact that I did not do much during, hardly anything during that time except, you know, really being emotionally in support of it, I felt guilty and felt that there was really a huge opportunity that I missed. And I was ultimately taking advantage of all the pain and suffering that the people who did go to the march and were assaulted by the hosing and the dogs and all of that. It's like, I should have done more. And I looked and tried to see, well, have I done anything? Because in my conversations, you know, with my friends here, the reason was that I don't think that I have done anything. And then I began to look, and I sort of also along this while, in terms of my own sense of openness to coming to these sessions, I sort of remembered a part of the letter from the Birmingham jail that Martin Luther King wrote. And the phrase that popped up for me, my paraphrase of it was, the people who are, that he was most disappointed in were not the Ku Klux Klanners or the racists and so forth, but the moderate people who were being quiet. That, and what he was saying was that it was really not enough to be supportive but quiet. You know, it was important for all of us to get involved in the process. And so that just reinforced, you know, my guilt or feeling that I had never gotten involved in the process. But when I started looking, I realized that that wasn't totally true, because even after graduating from graduate school, I was out where all the action was in the 60s in Berkeley, California, and I did start marching at that point, but it was, you know, the war against Vietnam, those marches, and I got very involved in that. And at the same time, I got very involved in a new movement that was beginning. And it was called, I don't know how many of you have heard about it, but in those days it was called Black White Encounter Groups. And that was one of the earliest opportunities that were presented for, mainly for blacks and whites, and Negroes and whites, to get together in small groups or in workshops to start talking about racial issues and try to better understand themselves and each other, to bring about some harmony or to bring about some peace, to really start, although we didn't use those words, but to begin to work on creating this beloved community. Now, as many things happen, so in some sense, almost the opposite happened. It turned out, in my estimation, to be opportunities for many good-hearted white people to come out and just have the opportunity of feeling very guilty and being beat up verbally, you know, by black people who were mad. And the opportunity for Negroes at that point to really have this opportunity to verbally beat up on whites, you know, and get rid of their frustration and anger and suffering and so forth. Well, and as leaders of these groups, you know, we weren't distant from that. You know, I spent a lot of time in my professional role of feeling okay, you know, about beating up on people. Until one day, a very, you know, good-hearted white guy who had been coming to a number of these sessions with his wife said something to me in effect, "You know, we really are sincere and really are interested in accomplishing change and changing ourselves, to looking in and making things better, but we don't really get the sense that you have, that you understand that, you know, that you're really beating up on us, and that doesn't help." And then within a little while, a few other people who had been coming regularly said essentially the same kinds of things. And I realized that I really needed to change my way, you know, if I was to be an instrument, you know, of bringing people together and having better understanding. So these black and white encounter groups that were only discussing racial issues at that time, this was back in the 60s, evolved into what currently are being called diversity groups, diversity sessions. And actually in the late 70s, I became involved in creating with some colleagues one of the earliest diversity trainings in corporations. And also through the years, I have developed a psychotherapy practice where I work with both whites and blacks along issues of really self-discovery and moving past suffering and so forth and better understanding themselves and others. And I say all this because I had not realized that that was a form of contribution to creating this beloved society, this beloved community. And I hadn't really looked at that. And that while it's really important to get on the front line and to march and to do those types of things, everyone, for whatever reason, may not be ready or able to do that. But there are other things that need to be done, you know, along the way. And it's important for all of us to look at the multitude of ways that we can contribute to making this a better place, to really being instrumental in creating a beloved community where all people are accepted and accepting. And I think that we're at the point now where we can broaden Martin's emphasis. His at that time was strictly on racial issues, on racism. And while there's still a lot of work that has to be done on that, there are also many other issues, prejudices and biases that we have to look at ourselves and that exist in society. There's still sexism, there's homophobia, there's ageism, classism. And I don't know if there's an ism that's connected with mental and physical ability, but there's ability-ism or something along those lines. So I think it's important for us to work all of those issues and to see where we stand and what we can do to really further the understanding and the acceptance of people regardless of their race, of their gender, of their sexual orientation, of their age, of their physical or mental ability, of their socioeconomic status. And I think that's really the task that is before all of us at this point, to see to what degree does that resonate with our thinking, you know, to what degree do we have the intention of becoming actively involved in some form to make this a better place. Again, whether this better place is New York Insight, whether it is the local community that you live in, that we live in, whether it's the United States or whether it's the world in general, or all of those. So, as I see it, there's lots of work for us to do, and it's not really appropriate to get bogged down with guilt or misreading what we have done or haven't done, but what's really important is to, if we're open to it, to set the intention of doing important work, making important strides in creating this beloved community that can exist. I think that's really the essence of what I wanted to share with you this evening, this morning, on this day. So maybe we could just take a couple minutes and be quiet and go inside and reflect.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.